Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, how you doing? This is Luis Sanacori Ramos, a.k.a. Taino Sagrado, or in Puerto Rico, como me dicen, El Rebelde Taino. I'd like to welcome everyone once again and all you live listeners out there who are tuning in. The time to call here at Guasamana Indigenous Radio is 516-387-1473. And don't be afraid, the last 15 minutes, if you want to call in, please, we're going to have, you know, we'll have you ask questions and so on. Listen, I'd like to thank all you countries out there, United States of America, first place. We have the Netherlands. We have Africa, especially Nigeria. Also, we have Canada. Oh, Canada, thank you for always tuning in. And also, we have our good friends and my neighbors here in Puerto Rico, Borinquen. And also, we have the UK. All right, England in the house. So I'd like to thank all you listeners tuning in, and also all you future listeners who will be downloading this show. Please spread the news, okay? Guasavara Indigenous Radio. Guasavara in the Taino language. Remember, the Taino were the people that discovered Columbus, told him he was lost. Guasavara means war. Now, this show talks about war, but it's not a war of violence, using weapons and so on. It's a show that relates to knowledge and information and how we can advocate for each other as a people, as a human race, also the animals, and especially our earth, as we indigenous world call it, our mother earth. So it's very important that this war is nonviolent, okay? Because Guasavara means that we care, that we care, that we will defend. Okay, it's indigenous out there, people. We are all one people. It's a good day for a race. That's right, the human race. So today we're going to have a very, very interesting show. It's the first show of many we're going to dedicate to climate change. I like to borrow a term used by Teocasin, Ghost Horse. He coined the term many years ago, climate crash. That's what it is. It's a collision course. Explosion is occurring, and we're looking at it every day in our environment. Just the other day on Facebook, I posted an article about that scientists here in Puerto Rico are desperately trying to save a lot of those petroglyph carvings by the beaches because of the water is rising. So a lot of these petroglyphs will be lost forever. So they're desperately trying to save these artwork. Traditionally, the Taino people, my ancestors, they used to carve these petroglyphs by the beaches. And these are all territorial markers. So we can all the tribes will share the wealth of the fish and the wildlife. But it's very historical, but because of the rising tides, you know, the waters rising due to climate change, climate crash, a lot of these artifacts are being lost forever. So right now, I'm just going to just give me a few seconds. My co-hostess, Kiyama, is a little late today. She's with her family, and she'll be joining us a little later. And I'm just going to go to the switchboard right now.
And it's very important to understand that there's a lot of people out there in the forefront, and they're trying their best to present advocacy. And the advocacy is very, very difficult because a lot of people, especially in this now, in this age of technology, a lot of people, let me just say this. This is my opinion. A lot of people are kind of resistant now, going out there and marching, going out there and being a force, you know. We're wonderful in the computer, you know, and it's a great tool. But sometimes we need that old-fashioned march, that old-fashioned protest, gathering of the people. So what's going to happen is I have a special guest today. And I'm looking at the switchboard. I have a little issue here. Hold on.
Yeah, I still need that intern. She hasn't been around yet. The switchboard is alive and well here, so I'm trying to negotiate. But we have Rivka Silver. She is an activist, and I believe you are live. Can you hear me, Rivka?
I can hear you. Thanks for having me.
Ah, perfect, perfect. Excellent. Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself? I'm having issues here with my my switchboard here. Actually, take a pause right there. Take a pause. Hold on a second. All you listeners out there, please listen up. There's a little issue with my switchboard. Sometimes it happens when I don't have assistance. Are you still with me, Rivka? I don't want to disconnect.
I'm here. Nope, I'm here. Don't worry. If we get disconnected, I'll call back.
All right. Good, very good. I'm just having some technical difficulties, but hold on a second. I wish I had some music to play. I don't know if you have a song to play, but we'll just hold on a second.
Let me see if I can get something up.
Okay.
Can you hear my music?
Okay, Rivka, I'm having issues here. Big time technical difficulties. So Rivka, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
For sure. I live in northern Manhattan, New York City.
Okay.
My wife and I recently had our first baby, and
nice.
It was a big moment.
Thank you.
Very life-changing. And, you know, priorities change and your perspective on the world changes when you become a parent. So what happened for me, or one of the things that happened for me, is it felt like a veil was kind of taken away from in front of my eyes on the urgency of climate crisis. So
okay.
I did, you know, I've done activism work before, but this having a baby really kind of shifted all my priorities into climate crisis, because the time is so urgent. So, I'm a teacher, I'm an activist, and really appreciative of you having me on the show, and for
yes.
any opportunities for communities to build solidarity and to work together.
Oh, no doubt. Well, let me ask you a question. Why is it so important to be an activist, especially in this climate change arena or, you know, field? What calls you to be an activist?
Thank you. It's a great question. There's three stages that we're dealing with. There's climate change, climate crisis,
right.
And climate chaos. So we've
passed.
Wow,
I like that word, chaos.
Chaos. Some people say climate catastrophe. You could say catastrophe or chaos, but it's the next stage. We are currently past climate change, which many indigenous communities already know this. Many non-indigenous communities are only starting to face this now. But so we're past climate change and we're in climate crisis. And we have the best science in the world tells us we have a very small window to prevent climate chaos. And once climate chaos starts, we can't undo it. There's a lot of things we can't undo, but the concern now is that in 2017, there was a report that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out. It's the best scientists in the world from many countries. And they said we had 12 years. This is in 2017. We had 12 years to prevent a 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature change from being locked in. And once that change got locked in, it would spark unending chain reactions beyond human control that would last for – the scientists say millennia, for thousands of years. It's a little heavy. It's hard to even wrap our head around. But so that year, in 2018, when we had 12 years left, carbon output actually increased that year. So instead of 2 years, carbon input went up. So what the scientists said is we had a 420 gigaton budget of carbon left that we could emit into the air until that 1.5 degree got locked in. Okay? So 420 gigatons, but that was based off of old emission rates. So when emissions went up, okay. 2 years later, we should have 10 years left. But now we actually have 8 because emissions have been going up, even though we know we're sleepwalking off the edge of a cliff is what a lot of scientists are saying. So the bad news is really, 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 really bad. It's really severely bad. It's really scary. It's very painful to even think about it accurately and honestly, because you just imagine yourself and your loved ones suffering in ways you can't really understand.
Sure.
But the good news
sure.
is we actually have enough time to do this. We're going to talk
okay.
about this more tonight, but we have the science. We have the technology,
mm-hmm.
we have the plans, we have the knowledge, we have the expertise, we even have the money to solve the problem. The only thing we lack is political will. Political will. And what that means is everyday people changing
mm-hmm.
their everyday life or maybe their weekly life to participate in the movement actively and regularly in order to force the government to follow the science. I have a lot more to say, but I just talked for a long time, so I'll leave it there for now. I've got all kinds of encouraging good things to encourage us as well after we look at the hard facts of what we're facing.
Okay, let me ask you one more time, 'cause I'm taking notes here. What are the different
Great.
Categories that are being used now? You said climate change. Okay, what was the first one? Climate change.
Yep, climate change. We're past that. You know, it became public knowledge 30 years ago in 1989,
okay.
at least in the States. I can only really speak to the American perspective, but I'm pretty sure that's worldwide. It became common knowledge that there was this thing called climate change. And if we
right.
kept going down this road, it was going to cause serious, kind of like ineffably difficult problems. That was in 1989.
Right.
And to tell you that what's crazier, this is even crazier, is that ExxonMobil actually did the first research on climate change. They sent out their freights and took ocean temperatures in the 70s. And they were
wow.
actually the ones who originally brought the science indicating climate change. So ExxonMobil has known since the beginning that this was happening. Later, they tried to dispute their own
wow.
research because they realized it could impact profit margins. So 30 years we've known as a society that climate change was
okay.
coming. And if you can believe it, 50% of the carbon emissions since the Industrial Revolution have come in those last 30 years. So that means
I can believe it. Yep.
It's hard to wrap your head around, but that's the truth. Okay. So, but climate change has been happening for a while now. We've had the last 60 years, heat waves in American cities have tripled. So climate change has been happening for a while, but now we're past the point of climate change and we're at climate crisis, meaning if we had started solving this problem in 1989, the rate at which we'd have to change our society would be much slower and much less stressful, but we didn't do that.
Right.
Not to, you know, it's not, the blame isn't really on working people, and honestly, I'm not really that interested in assigning blame at this point. It's really just about going forward. But
right.
the crisis is this time crunch. We're under this immense time crunch to solve it. And not even just
right.
like people, a lot of people, I think I can speak more particularly for my communities and non-Indigenous communities in general, because I am not myself Indigenous. But I think a lot of
right.
non-Indigenous communities think about climate change as like, oh, the polar bears won't have a place to live, which is true and which is devastating. That life
right.
is sacred, and it took billions of years for that life to evolve. And like, imagine the loss of losing polar bears. But it's also
sure.
a lot more than that. It's about like our
Definitely.
You and my, and our listeners' ability to live. We're not even talking about our grandkids anymore. So that's the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about, we will be immediately impacted if we haven't been already. People in Puerto Rico already know this. From the climate catastrophe that's been going on there, along with government
right.
Abandonment. And
exactly.
so the crisis is trying to avoid climate catastrophe, because as bad as it's been for so many communities already, the
right.
1.5 degree tipping point, that 1.5 degree lock-in of increased temperature since pre-industrial revolution era, is going to start a chain reaction with feedback loops that is completely beyond human control. So we're talking about ever-increasing wildfires, ever and much, much, much stronger. In California, it used to be a big deal if there was a 10,000-acre wildfire. Now, every year, you're seeing these 60, 70, 80,000-acre wildfires, totally unheard of. In the Bay, they have air warnings, air quality warnings. That never used to happen. This has been the last 3 or 4 years. So as bad as things are, they're going to get worse, kind of like beyond what many humans can even fathom. It's really hard to wrap your head around. So the crisis that we're in is preventing the catastrophe.
Right.
And it's complicated because you have to hold two things at once. The situation is so dire. It is so bad. There's a sense of panic that's necessary to act appropriately. And
at the same time, we
actually can change it still. So I really want listeners to be able to hold on to the hope. Not so much hope that people don't act, because hope can be like a almost like an opiate, and it's like, oh, I don't have to act, it's going to be okay. But there needs to be a balance of panic and hope, and that's what the crisis is. There's still hope, but it's very urgent.
Rivka, just a little sound check. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me still?
Okay. Yep. That's great. Basically, it's chaos, and you can feel it in the air. You know, you can definitely feel it in the air, how chaotic it can get, the climate and so on. Let me ask you a question. To get to the nuts and bolts, what is going on right now with the climate at the moment?
Yeah.
What do you see?
So there's a lot of things. And it's kind of been like a building accruing effect over time, and it's kind of all coming to a head right now. So one thing is that there's very intense soil degradation around the world, mostly from the agro industry, so like the way farming's done, but especially the way meat and dairy and eggs are produced in the world. So the appetite for meat and dairy and eggs has grown and grown and grown over the years. And so you have factory farming that has really intense degrading effects on the soil. So what that means is we've lost 33% of the world's arable land in the last 40 years. 33%.
How many
so
percent?
One
How much? How much?
33.
How much?
Almost 33%.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. And it's that loss is past, but it's happening now still, and it's accelerating. If you go online, you can find areas of China where people are trying to do certain planting techniques to prevent the desertification, like the turning of arable land into desert. So they're the deserts are spreading, but they're doing their best to stave it off. So that's one thing, is that the population is growing. In 30 years, we'll have 10 billion people, they estimate. How will we possibly feed 10 billion people if we continue to lose arable land at the rate we are? We could have only a third of the arable land left that we started with, a third left. We could lose 67% of our arable land in the next 30 years, feeding 10 billion people on a third of the land.
That's just insanity. That's just insanity. It's insane.
It's insanity. It's insane. And it's like, okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is, like, with the warming climate, mosquitoes are gaining more and more and more ground and more territory. So scientists estimate within coming decades, an additional 2 billion, with a B, 2 billion people, additional people, will be at risk for mosquito-borne diseases. So that means, like, malaria and Zika. Zika, for people who don't know, I'm sure there are listeners who do know, is so severe that there have been governments warning people against having reproductive sex for years because the risk to fetuses is so severe. So, like, the extent to which mosquito-borne diseases can disrupt or end life is really hard to overstate. And we're talking about 2 billion additional people having those risks.
2 billion?
In Jakarta, 2 billion additional people in the coming decades because of the warming planet.
Wow.
This is preventable, though. This is preventable. That's the news. We're not in chaos yet. We're in crisis. It goes climate change, climate crisis, climate chaos. So these stats I'm giving
you
are about climate chaos, and we can prevent it still. Okay, so that's one piece. Another piece is that, people in Puerto Rico already know this, but the water is rising. People in many places know this.
Yes.
Jakarta, the capital of Jakarta in Indonesia, is currently moving. They're moving the capital because the water is rising so much. So that's currently happening. They're moving the capital.
Can you repeat that again for our listeners? What is the capital and where? In Indonesia?
Yeah, in Indonesia, Jakarta, they're moving the capital because it sits right on water and the water's rising. It's sinking. The city's sinking, so they're moving the capital. I think it's important to really highlight that because it really shows you the difference outside of certain first world contexts, so-called first world contexts. People are much more tapped in to how dire the situation is. In the United States, if you suggested people move cities, people would think you're crazy. But it's literally already happening in other countries. That's a major piece of it. There's a great example for Americans. I think, my work personally is trying to help non-Indigenous Americans really face more honestly what's happening. Because I think for a lot of non-Indigenous people, and I can only speak for myself, there's such intense alienation from Mother Nature that there's this block that they think Mother Nature doesn't affect them. And actually, before I go any further, I do want to say just thank you and give – I'm Jewish, and in Judaism we have this concept called Hakara Satov. It means like gratitude or recognizing the good. So I want to give proper Hakara Satov to the indigenous communities that have been and indigenous peoples that have been at the forefront of this fight for literally generations upon generations.
Thank you.
I can't really say thank you enough. The work is priceless, and it's like, a lot of non-Indigenous people, if they've been involved for maybe a few years and maybe at the absolute maximum 30 years. And Indigenous communities and Indigenous peoples have been doing this for hundreds of years. So just first things first, I just want to recognize the Indigenous communities that are at the front of climate crisis work.
Thank you. Rivka, can we make a pause there for a minute?
Sure.
I remember several years ago, I had the honor of leading a march to the UN, and it was spiritual leaders from South America, Mexico, and the Southwest. And it was it was an amazing experience for me. And there's two things that really stood out. And when we were walking the streets of New York City from the West Village to the UN, to the East Side, there was one of the medicine women that was with us. She kept stopping. And not that she was tired. She was stopping because when you walk the streets in New York, sometimes you see these little plants growing out of the cement, She knew what those plants were, and she would stop to pick them because they were medicinal plants. And she would stop and say a prayer to that plant, and it says wow, look at you, you're so beautiful, and then she put it in her bag, and she said that she's going to use it as medicine. So that was one thing that struck me, that relationship she had with the plant world, And then the other part that was amazing, there was a woman there. She was from the Kuna people in Panama. And she was telling us that their stories, their oral traditions, what people call myths, for them, it's, their teaching moments. And what happened was, because of the climate at the time, we used to say climate change, there was four stories that they tell when the seasons change. And just when the seasons is about to change, that's when they tell these stories to the kids. And then the kids are mesmerized because they can see the change around them, And she was telling us that one of the stories is about the rattlesnakes, that there's a certain period that the rattlesnakes come out, and I believe it was during the springtime. And then they bring all the kids to this part of the forest where they can see all the rattlesnakes come out or be born, you know, and so on, you know, at a safe distance, of course. And then the kids will be mesmerized by that, you know. That's just one example I remember. But because of the climate change, the rattlesnakes weren't being born. Because something dealing with the river, it was something with the river, like the river just took over this area. So the kids were like mocking the elders, like, oh, this is such a lie, you know. We don't see any rattlesnakes, you know. So a whole generation was, you know, was like lost, you know, because of the climate change. And I hear these stories over and over.
Oh no, it's a great point, and I think I think what you're talking about is the loss of human culture in a very deep way. Is very hard. I don't really know if it is grievable. In the best case scenario, there's going to be an immense amount lost of human culture, even if we succeed in our goals as activists. And honestly, I think that's part of the reason why it's hard for people to get involved in the struggle, is because there's such an immense amount of grief that comes with recognizing where we are. I also think there's an immense amount of potential for good. And like, this is a historical moment that we can seize. So I do have hope, but I think what you're pointing to is this cultural loss that's priceless. It's a priceless piece of human experience.
Oh yes, and you can see the mourning that took place when that story was shared to us, the group, because it was like a mourning period. You know?
How did people?
Oh yeah,
mourn?
So continue on. Yeah, continue. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, it was like a mourning period.
Yeah.
So yes, continue on. I'm sorry I interrupted you a little bit.
Oh no, not at all. I mean, basically, so one of the examples I give with what's going on with the climate that I give to Americans in particular, and particularly non-Native Americans, is what happened in Paradise, California last year. So like I mentioned before, it used to be a big deal on the west of the United States when there was a 10,000-acre wildfire. And now you see 60, 70, 80,000-acre wildfires more and more common. They're just exponentially larger fires, and these fires move much, much faster than they used to. And so it's going past the human capacity to respond quickly to these fires. They're so powerful and they're so fast that they're out of control. Like, humans can't control them in the way we're used to controlling fires. So last year in Paradise, California, it's a small town of 27,000 people. And it's important to note, it's one of the best prepared communities in the entire state of California to escape wildfire. They're just a very well-prepared community. But this particular fire last year was so fast. The New York Times actually said it was so destructive. The New York Times described it as being at the limits of the American imagination and a preview of the American future. So this town, it was 27,000 people. It was flattened. Experts by this fire. It just moves too fast. There's an article on the Times, if people can have access to it and feel comfortable reading in English, I really advise you to go on. I think there might be a Spanish translation of the article, but I'm not sure. It's called We Have Fire Everywhere. It's by the New York Times. It's from they published it, I believe it was published last year, but maybe this year. We Have Fire Everywhere. So it talks, it's excellent journalism, but it talks about how in the article, the experts explain it was basically impossible to build enough highways to allow the people who had stayed and didn't get the evacuation order to escape quickly enough. And this was a small town. So there's like some thousands of people there. It wasn't even everyone. But there's like, I don't know, 5,000-10,000 people there. And it was impossible to build enough highway to allow people to escape fast enough. So this fire
That's
moved
amazing.
So quickly. It's a really terrifying article, and I think – it serves a purpose. It can help you. There's a mental block I know a lot of people in my life have, and I had myself seen this honestly, and it's our job to chip away at that block, and this article can help you do that, and then you get tapped into the movement. Afterwards, you funnel that panic in a positive way. But so there's a flame in this fire. The flame was 200 feet tall and 2.5 miles wide. And it was at certain points literally burning and just devouring homes by the minute, multiple homes. There's one piece where the fire – and people are sitting in traffic, right, because they can't – there aren't enough roads to – it's not really possible to build enough roads to escape this disaster quickly enough. The article talks about it's the point of a community isn't to escape it. Communities aren't built to escape them. They're built to live in them. So people are sitting in traffic while this fire is ravaging through the town because they're trying to leave not enough roads. At one point, they talk about one woman panicking because the fire is getting closer. She literally got out of her car and left her car idle in traffic and ran for her life, I think for a couple miles, to get away from the flame.
That's terrible.
It's crazy. There was a group of nurses who evacuated the hospital. You can imagine – one thing I want people to imagine is if you're able-bodied, if your body can, like, walk around and climb stairs and run, think about people who can't do that. This is going to affect everyone, first of all, but just think of the vulnerability of, like, someone in the hospital during a climate crisis or someone who uses a wheelchair. So one example is that there's an ambulance. This is in Paradise, California, again. An ambulance caught fire with a woman inside of it who had just had a C-section and was paralyzed from the waist down. A group of nurses had evacuated patients and were suddenly stranded in the fire. And so they don't know what they're going to do. They're fearing for their lives. And at the same moment, it's a complicated story. It's worth reading. But there was a heavy equipment operator for the fire department in the area who was responding to an emergency distress call from another firefighter who was trying to avoid being killed by the fire. So this guy was driving this bulldozer.
Wow.
He was crashing through houses. He was trying to get there as fast as he could. And he came upon this group of stranded nurses. And the nurses were so panicked that one of them, you know, there's four of them. One of them goes out and starts waving his arms in front of the bulldozer that's going as fast as it can. And the nurse explained, the driver was either going to see him and stop, or he wasn't going to see him because it was so smoky and he was going to crush him to death. But the nurse was in so much pain. His lungs were – it was so painful because the fire was so close. The nurse was like, you know what? I made peace with either way. He's either going to save me, he's going to kill me, but I'm going to go either way. When we talk about this type of fire, that's what – like increasing wildfires all over the world, that's what we're talking about. And of course, when these fires have escalating impacts, so tons of crops are lost. The oxygen level is so bad that tons of people adapt asthma or are killed by asthma. The soil is further degraded. I mean, it has these huge impacts. So that's a good example I give. Now, again, Paradise, California, it's a town of 27,000 people. It experienced $20 billion of damage, $20 billion. Billion with a B. It's 27,000
wow.
people. We're not talking about Chicago. We're not talking about Santo Domingo. We're not talking about Hong Kong. We're not talking about people with large populations. We're talking about 27,000 people, $20 billion of damage. So one thing I really want to emphasize, because we're going to talk about the Green New Deal at some point, whenever yeah. anyone says the Green New Deal is expensive, everything we sacrifice in this moment has to be compared to the alternative outcome. So a lot of times, if I'm, for example, I can just tell, you know, and it's real sacrifice. I don't want to downplay the sacrifice. It's real. But it's just important we compare that sacrifice in the right direction. So, for example, I recently gave up all animal products because I was like, how can I do this with good conscience when I have a child and I know the impact of animal products, right? So, that's a big sacrifice. Like culturally, Jews, we have this thing called Shabbos or Shabbat, and we want to do the COVID Shabbos. We want to give honor to the Jewish Sabbath, and one of the ways we do that is by preparing meat. We have another concept called Achnasas Orchim, hospitality. It's a very serious value of ours. You give your guests absolute best you can, and for me, that's meant meat. So giving up meat is a real cultural loss that needs to be respected. But I'm not comparing that sacrifice anymore. to my previous life where I enjoyed meat, I'm comparing it to my future life,
right,
where I know I have to have done everything I can. So
yes.
When the group, when people say the Green New Deal is expensive, you have to compare it to what's coming in the future. Hundreds of billions of dollars of damage every single year from natural disasters. This money is going to get spent one way or another. It can either be spent preventing the worst disasters to come, or it can be spent treating them. But it's going to get spent either way.
Well, let me ask you a question, Rivka. What is the? Can you explain to our listeners out there what is the new, the Green New Deal?
Exactly. Yep. So, it's a great question. It is so. Just a very brief history lesson. In the United States, during the Depression era, in the late 20s, 30s, 40s, et cetera, the economy crashed so badly that Roosevelt, the president at the time, helped craft what he called a New Deal. And he totally remade the American economy with a ton of government initiatives in order to bring the American people out of the worst depression they'd seen. So, you know, you can see pictures of young men who don't have shirts, like they're suffering such intense poverty, they don't have shirts, and they're riding trains looking for work. The poverty was a really desperate situation then, and it was very, very widespread. We deal with a lot of poverty today, obviously, as well, but there was a mobilization called the New Deal. It was a huge government initiative with a ton of money spent to remake the American economy, and it brought us out of the Depression. So now the new that was in, you know, that was in the earlier early mid 20th century. Now, flash forward, we have this idea of the new Green Deal. So remember, we have this timeline. We were supposed to have 12 years before we used up our carbon budget. Now we have 8 because the carbon budget actually got spent faster in the last 2 years than before. And so we have 8 years left to prevent locking in a 1.5 degree Celsius change. And once we lock, that's when climate catastrophe or climate chaos starts. Like that California fire, that could be everywhere. There, I mean, like 74% of the 74% of the world population in the world will be exposed to heat waves hot enough to kill. That's the estimation.
Wow.
So 74% of the world. Exactly. If 74% of the world could be exposed to heat waves hot enough to kill, that means there will be massive, massive pressures for migration. Just massive social unrest and lack of safety. So the Green New Deal recognizes that we have 8 years, 8.5 years to remake our economy. And the good news is it's actually technically feasible. People hear that timeline, they say, wait, is that even possible? The good news is, yes, it actually is possible. There are many industries who have totally remade themselves in less than 10 years. The scale of the change is unprecedented, but the timeline isn't. So
okay.
The Green New Deal says, listen, what we have to do to prevent climate catastrophe is to go to net zero carbon emissions before the budget is used up, net zero. Does that mean zero? It means net zero.
Right.
So carbon is produced by all kinds of things. Traveling in the airplane, you know, humans just produce it like living. You could buy products. It's, you know, factories make carbon, oil, obviously. Any sort of fossil fuel extraction, fracking, natural gas, all these sorts of things emit greenhouse gases. So we have to get to net zero carbon emissions before the budget's used up. The Green New Deal is basically putting that plan in action. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Just gave me an idea. I was talking to one of my friends here in Puerto Rico. He's an engineer. One day I'm going to have him on the show and talk about alternatives to carbon footprints.
Yeah, yeah.
And what he says, like here in the island of Puerto Rico, there is the technology already for it. When you create these pumps throughout surrounding the island and the – and these pumps go in the ocean, and with the waves of the ocean, it creates energy, you know?
Yeah.
And the technology is there, you know? He showed me the technology, you know? And he's going to use it because he lives by a river. He lives by a river. Oh. He's going to use the same technology to get energy from the river. But the thing is, the government, the corporations, they're not supporting this.
No. They're not supporting it.
So So in this new green new the Green New Deal, will it fund these kind of projects, like what my friend is saying, this technology to get energy?
Definitely. Yeah. So the Green New Deal right now is this movement called the Sunrise Movement in the United States. It also has a little bit of presence in Sweden and South Africa, if anyone's listening from Sweden or South Africa. But the Green New Deal, as it currently exists, is a very ambitious plan that's going to need some time to be spelled out. But basically what the Green New Deal says is we know we have to get to net carbon emissions in order to have a chance at saving, really, literally saving our planet and saving our ability to live decent lives. So all kinds of technologies are going to be used, right? Solar and wind are big ones. For sure, you're talking about the oceanic and like water hydropower. I think a lot of technology is going to be looked at. So we do have a lot of technology. One concept I want to introduce, if listeners aren't already familiar, is this idea of carbon sequestration, literally like sucking the carbon out of the air. So we have Mother Nature, God-given. Yeah. There's a lot of hope that like, we have the ability to do this. I think what you highlighted about the corporations is that there are people who have been blinded by their obsession with money, and there's just an ability to think somehow they can escape this. And so corporations, I think it's something you can look it up. I think it's something like 70 or 80 corporations produce like 90% of the world's carbon emissions. So just to put that in perspective, but we know that there's a way to do this. So I would just say that the Green New Deal is going to be made up like the New Deal was in the 30s, 40s, 50s, is going to be made up of many, 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 many pieces of legislation. It's like a huge government program that will made up of many pieces of legislation. But we have God-given technology and we have human-made technology. The God-given technology, which is mind-blowing when you read about it, one is that there's room for approximately 1.3 trillion trees to be planted around the world. Scientists estimate using Google Maps and things like that in parks and abandoned lands and open spaces. So 1.3 trillion trees would suck 100 gigatons of carbon out of the air. So that's significant.
That's amazing.
And there are governments all over the world that are actually already committed to planting many trees. I'd have to double check, but I think Ghana might be one of them planting like millions of trees in the coming years. So pushing our governments to do that. I mean, I think the biggest thing, I just want to say this over and over again, is if listeners are inspired to act, and I really hope they are, to join with movements in your community. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. It's time for us to become followers of the people who have been thinking about this and working on this for a long time. But so there's 1.3, there's room for 1.3 billion trees. There's other amazing God-given technology in that I talked earlier about the impact of soil degradation. So soil restoration, if we put in a $300 billion investment, this is out of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. Bloomberg Business Week magazine put out a report that scientists say $300 billion investment in soil restoration could buy us another 15 to 20 years before locking in the 1.5 degrees Celsius change. Again, 1.5 degrees Celsius change is the tipping point from climate crisis to climate chaos or climate catastrophe. So that's what we're trying to work against. Getting to a net zero carbon emissions economy before that tipping point. But if we did $300 billion investment in soil restoration, it would give us another 15 to 20 years. We wouldn't have 8.5. We'd have like 23 or 28 years. And to put that in perspective, $300 billion is what the world spends on military spending every 60 days, every 60 days, every 2 months. The world spends $300 billion on military expenditures. So we have the money to do these projects.
Sure.
And this is, I mean, I found, when I first, oh, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
No, all you have to do is gut out the military budget, and you got all these different programs can be funded. But
yeah.
so much is
yeah.
is pumped into the military.
Yeah, it really is. And the military, the U.S. military is one of the biggest polluters in the world. So there's a lot to work against. But the again, I said this earlier, but if anyone's joining us new, we have the technology, both human-made and God-given. We have the expertise. We have the science. We have the plans.
Yep.
We have the money. We have everything we need. We just lack political will. And political will is really important. There's some really beautiful special research out of, by a sociologist or a political scientist out of Harvard University named Erica Chenoweth. Erica Chenoweth,
okay.
a political scientist at Harvard University. She studied social movements from the past 106 years. And she found that two things, and it's really amazing, and I hope people will really contemplate this and act on it. Two things.
Right.
One is that nonviolent movements were twice as successful as violent movements. And so they have a bunch of theories around this. One is that more people are just prone to participate if it's nonviolent. Violent movements tend to depend on a smaller segment of society, which is like able-bodied, young, single men. In nonviolent movements, you've got parents, you've got older people, you've got elders, you've got babies coming to the march. So it's a very different percentage of society that participates. So
okay.
nonviolent movements are twice
sure.
as successful, but this is the real thing. She found that every single movement that she studied, every single movement that had a 3.5% active participation rate or higher, every single movement succeeded. So this 3.5% of the population participating is a magic number. If 3.5% of people are actively participating in the struggle for the Green New Deal, that means like once or twice a week after work, they're going to protest. Maybe they're taking work off on Friday mornings. There's a movement building called Fridays for Future. Greta Thunberg, I believe, started it in Sweden. They're actively participating every week. Say they're making calls on behalf, like pushing politicians. They're in the streets protesting. If 3.5% do that, it is inevitable that we will win this struggle. 3.5%, it's a good amount of people,
well,
but it's actually not that many, right? It's
well,
not
you
50%.
Know
what? It's, yeah.
No, but you know, when the governor of Puerto Rico here, that whole Ricky movement to remove him
yeah.
after a manuscript was released, 50%
yeah.
of the population came and protested. 50%. That's
yeah,
why. That's why he left. That's why he left. He couldn't stay.
That's
50%.
Right.
Imagine.
The pressure
you know?
Is unimaginable. It's unimaginable. And I think about it. It's like that's like overthrowing a government. And I think that just that's one example
yeah.
of many, 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 many examples
sure.
Outside of the so-called first world where people are more they're more primed to be politically active. They're more ready. And so
right.
My hope is that Americans will follow in indigenous and third world leaders
sure.
example
sure.
by being ready to act. But 3.5%. So if there's like, oh my gosh, how are we possibly going to do this work? The task is so big. This is so overwhelming. Just remember, we have to do our part. And if we can organize our families, organize our communities,
yes.
our religious communities, we can get that 3.5% threshold, whether it's in Ghana
well,
or South Africa or United States or Puerto Rico.
Right. I know you had mentioned before about climate strike. What is the goal of the climate strike then? Climate strike.
Yeah. So, yeah. Exactly. So, climate strike. There's been a ton of young people, teenagers, often doing activism around this for a number of years. One of them is Greta Thunberg, who hadn't really been. She wasn't really known until pretty recently. I think it was a year ago, maybe a year and a half. She's Swedish,
okay.
and she lives in Sweden, and she started going on strike from school every Friday. And her concept
yeah.
was, what good is school if the things I'm learning in school, mainly that climate crisis is here and that we have to prevent this in order to live our lives, if that knowledge I learned in school isn't even being used, what good is this studying I'm doing? So she went on strike from school every Friday, and she just stood in front of government buildings, and no one knew who she was. The press eventually caught on to it. Fast forward a year and a half later, and she has an audience in front of the UN. And the basic idea is that society cannot continue business as usual, right? We have to my motto is every person has to do everything they can. Now, some people will not be able to do that much, but they can do something still, and they can talk to their families. Some people are going to be able to do a lot more. But one of the ideas of business as usual cannot continue is this idea like Fridays for future, striking on Fridays in order for our future.
Okay.
So the, there's
okay.
a exactly right. And the strike is pushing the government to enact the Green New Deal, to start it in process. The truth is there's very little chance of that happening while Donald Trump is in office. So the Sunrise Movement, which is the organization I work with, also is pushing to elect people who will support the Green New Deal all across the country, and are in the process of possibly endorsing a presidential candidate. So we have a presidential race coming up. And we have a presidential race coming up that is so vital. The Democrats are currently campaigning to see who's going to be on the ticket. And we're pushing for the strike is to bring the Green New Deal to the forefront of public discussion and to push for our politicians to put it in action. It's basically like follow the science. And what follow the science. We have the science. Do you believe in it or don't you? Then we have to act. So I used to question myself, what really is like the role or the importance of strikes and protests? Is it really going to do anything? I think that concept of if 3.5% actively participate in a movement, particularly in public, that movement's success becomes inevitable. 3.5%, that really shows the power of striking. When people see groups of people gathered in public, it has a real impact on people. When people see groups of people gathered and they know they left work or they left school, they're making some sort of sacrifice, either social or material, money or standing in their community sometimes even, that makes an impact on people. So we want more and more and more people to come out in the streets, to join these strikes. Hopefully this is going to become a weekly thing. Not everyone's going to be able to do it every week, but many people would. Many people, you know, I've been encouraging my friends, like the strike I'm having here in Washington Heights is at 10 a.m. So you could come for a couple hours and then go to work late. You don't have to quit your job. You don't have to like totally undo your life. But we do have to, gather. We have to do it in public. So just to plug our strike, we're having a climate strike. There's a series of strikes across the entire country in the United States. There was a big climate strike in September. There's another series of strikes happening this Friday, December 6th. The strike in Washington Heights is at 720 West 181st Street, New York, New York, 10040. Again, that's 720 West 181st Street, New York, New York, 10040 at 10 a.m. this Friday, December 6th. But people can find strikes all over the country, all over in their communities. You can go by searching. Can you still hear me? I wasn't sure if you cut out.
That's amazing.
Can you still hear me?
Because I wish I was. I hear you.
Okay, great.
So that'll be this Friday, December 6th?
This Friday, December 6th. And if people want to find a strike, there's literally hundreds of these strikes happening in the United States. You can go to sunrisemovement.org/climate strike. So sunrisemovement.org/climate strike. You type in your zip code or your city, you can find a climate strike anywhere. I'm looking at the map right now of climate strikes. They're all over the country. And it's time to show in numbers. You know, the majority of Americans, 70% of Americans believe in climate strike. 70%. A lot of people think it's lower. It's actually a majority.
Well, you know, many years ago during the Standing Rock protest, you know, when the water protectors was trying to stop the pipeline,
Yeah.
It's it was an amazing movement until the corporations got involved and Trump got involved. A lot of people got paid off on that one. But it really brought it to center stage, and I love how the media tried to block it, you know. But it got so big that it was huge. So I think it's very important that the native people who are listening, the indigenous peoples, you know, we got to step up. We got to step up and really fight hard. This is what Osabana is all about. It's war, but it's a nonviolent war to help our earth, help the seventh generation, as in a native tradition we say.
Yeah.
You know, all those children not yet born. So it's, I mean, we really got to unify more than ever right now, you know?
Yeah. And unity is a good word. Unity is a good word.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a naughty word, because sometimes people who cry out unity don't really want unity, you know, they want division. So I think it's important that leaders in this movement, this strike, you know, we really have to, I shouldn't say the leaders, the protesters, you know, we really got to be serious about this and, you know, challenge leaders. And this is great, because we're challenging our political leaders to pass this new Green Deal. So, you know, this is it. We got no alternative. We got to do this. We got to do this.
You know,
yeah, sound that drum, man. We got to do it.
Yep. And it's going to be an intense. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
It's going to be intense what?
It's going to be intense, you know, 8 years coming up. And it's like I appreciate what you said about unity. You have to be careful. Some people call for unity. What they mean is they want you to do just what they want you to do and follow them. But in terms of the spiritually productive type of unity, you know, I'm like any other person. I can be kind of petty sometimes, and some person can annoy me, or maybe I have beef with someone. But the truth is, when you look, for me, I'll speak for myself. When I look at it from this perspective of what we're coming up against in the next 8 years, I think, you know, is it really that important? Sometimes it is. Sometimes you really shouldn't mess with people, because they don't have your best interest at heart. But there are a lot of petty grievances I might have with someone that become irrelevant in the face of what we're about to do. And I know personally, and I think a lot of people out there have a sense and know themselves, that we're going to really need each other to get through these next 8 years in a very core way. We're going to need each other. So when I have some beef with someone, oh, they said this 3 years ago and I still haven't forgiven them, I think to myself, in lieu of what is going on, is this really important? And often it's no.
Exactly.
Once in a while, you still need to keep your distance from certain people, but for the most part, it's not such a big deal. And so what my focus in my personal life right now is building my relationships, seeing the good in people and trying to bring that out of them in order to help them feel psychologically prepared to engage in the struggle we're in. But unity is a special thing. It's like, it's time to draw closer to our loved ones and to draw closer to the people that that we surround ourselves with, because we're going to need each other.
That is so powerful. Definitely, we have to look for the good in each other. If not, we're doomed, right? We have to, man. This is it. Let's try to make
this
a unified effort, because you know, we gotta try. You know, I when you mentioned about movements, the 3%. You know, the first war ever won against a nation without shooting one bullet was Mohandas Gandhi, right? He led a whole movement.
Yeah.
Without shooting one bullet, you know. So, you know, there's hope. There's precedence to this. So, listen, I'd like to thank you, Rivka Silva. Thank you for being on our show.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. We got like a little less than a minute left. And
thank you so much.
Please, all you listen. Yeah.
I would say, if anyone wants to be in touch with me, you can email me at yre5774@gmail.com. You're welcome to be in touch. That's yre5774@gmail.com if you want tips or help or thoughts, like getting started. And find a climate strike near you at sunrisemovement.org/climate strike.
This is awesome. And we got to talk about maybe when I get back to New York, setting up an indigenous contingency, you know?
And
help
yeah,
with this.
Yeah, great.
and help with the strike. We'll bring the drum, you know.
Yeah, I said this earlier.
Yeah?
I just want to say again to give Hakar Satov, to give proper gratitude to the indigenous communities who have been doing this for centuries and for generations. Just to say thank you, and your work is precious to us.
Oh man, thank you, and I love my Jewish brothers and sisters because we're all indigenous. You know, we all have connection to the land. We all and family. And if we all band together, man, that's it. We will be unstoppable if all our nations band together. We'll be unstoppable.
And
prevent those
I
fires.
We're at a tipping point. Yeah, totally.
Right.
We're at a tipping
prevent
point.
Those fires.
I think Americans are ready. I think we're at a tipping point. It's very different in the conversation that was 4 years ago because people are ready in a way they weren't before. So we can do this. We gotta key into the movement. We gotta find the movement and participate actively.
Yep. Exactly. And there's a lot of protesting here in Puerto Rico. A lot of great people out here and are doing good stuff. That I'm going to have them on future shows. But, man, thank you for all the information you shared with us. It's going to be archived. Please share it. And we'll have you back soon. We'll have a panel, you know. We'll have you back.
That sounds great.
And see.
I'd love to be here.
Yeah, and see how the movement is growing, okay? We got this. So thank you,
Rika,
and blessings to you. And thank you all you listeners out there who are listening in, and also all you future listeners who are downloading this. Please share. This is Guasawara Indigenous Radio. See you next show. Peace out.